both with management and among the rank and file. Why? Because again, empowering people is the fruit of the other three roles, not the root. We surveyed 3,500 managers and professionals in client organizations and asked this question: what's holding back empowerment? Notice how their answers underscore the importance of both personal and organizational trustworthiness on both dimensions of character and competence. Managers afraid to let go, 97%. Misaligned systems, 93%. Managers lack skills, 92%. Employees lack skills, 80%. Employees don't want responsibility, 76%. Manager too busy, 70%. Management too controlling, 67%. Lack of company vision, 64%. Employees don't trust the manager, 49%. Employees lack integrity, 12%. Now that you've soaked deeper in this whole person, four-role paradigm of leadership, you can see why people would become frustrated when empowerment efforts are undertaken without the foundational modeling, pathfinding, and aligning work being done first. New heading: The Manager's Dilemma. Do I give up control? A few years ago, I remember interviewing the chief executive of a company who had just received the prestigious Malcolm Baldrige National Quality Award. I asked him, "What was your toughest challenge as CEO in achieving this level of quality in your organization?" With but a moment of thought, he smiled and said, "Giving up control." Empowerment will always be a cynicism-inducing platitude unless it's rooted in solid modeling, pathfinding, and aligning work. The four roles of leadership break the manager's dilemma of being caught between control and fear of losing control. When you truly establish the conditions for empowerment, control is not lost. It is simply transformed into self-control. Self-control does not come when you simply abandon people in the name of empowerment. It comes when there is a commonly understood end in mind, with agreed-upon guidelines and supportive structures and systems, and when each person is set up as a whole person in a whole job. Training and coaching is provided to those who lack the competence required to be fully entrusted with greater freedom. A track record of consistent performance earns greater and greater trust and latitude in methods. People become accountable for results and have the freedom within guidelines to achieve those results in a way that taps into their unique talents. I call this directed autonomy. The manager's role then shifts from controller to enabler, commissioning with people, removing barriers, and becoming a source of help and support. That is quite a shift. When we discuss the trim-tabbing leader who was full of vision, discipline, passion, and conscience, we were talking about self-empowerment. Now, in the larger context, we're looking at how to create an official, institutionalized, formalized philosophy of empowerment. Ideally, you would like to have both personal and organizational empowerment so that a person doesn't have to swim upstream against disempowering cultural and organizational forces. New heading: The Empowering Tool. The win-win agreement process. Think about the whole win-win process as two volunteers who co-mission together, one representing the organization and the other representing the stakeholders, team, or individual. Max Dupree, who wrote the brilliant book Leadership is an Art, describes the spirit of volunteers working together. Quote, "The best people working for organizations are life volunteers. Since they could probably find good jobs in any number of groups, they choose to work somewhere for reasons less tangible than salary or position. Volunteers do not need contracts. They need covenants. Covenantal relationships induce freedom, not paralysis. A covenantal relationship rests on shared commitment to ideas, to issues, to values, to goals, and to management process. Words such as love, warmth, personal chemistry are certainly pertinent. Covenantal relationships fill deep needs, and they enable work to have meaning and to be fulfilling. A win-win agreement is not a formal job description, neither is it a legal contract. It's an open-ended, psychological, social contract that explicitly defines expectations. It is written first into the hearts and minds of people, and then often put on paper in pencil rather than in ink, so that easy erasing can take place when both sense it is appropriate and wise. You can discuss and renegotiate it at will based on changing circumstances. Whether people use the language win-win agreements or not, the idea is that you have to have a common understanding and commitment toward your highest mutual priorities. Win-win agreements enable a much higher level of flexibility, adaptation, and creativity than do job descriptions, which focus primarily on steps and methods. With the win-win agreement, we look at the situation, maturity, character, and competence of team members and formal leaders, and other environmental conditions, such as the presence of aligned structures, systems, and processes. Once a win-win agreement has been developed, the answer to the question, "What's my or our top priority?" is abundantly clear. Responsibilities are laid out. Mutual expectations are articulated. Accountability to these expectations in the form of a balanced scoreboard is established. People are free to do whatever they need to do to accomplish the goals within the context of the guidelines. They simply manage themselves. They become empowered. In Chapter 14, The Eighth Habit and the Sweet Spot, much more will be said on how to foster strong, enabling team accountability. New heading, Win-Win Empowerment, Moving from the Industrial to the Knowledge Worker Age. Now, what if we were to forget all that we've learned about the whole person? What if we lost sight of the fire that is lit inside those individuals and organizations when they find their voice and inspire others to find their voice? And we kept working through our traditional industrial age lenses and traditions. Can you see how easy it would be to apply the win-win agreement process in the classic style of a controlling manager? You can see all that the effort simply would not yield the fruit of empowerment. Successful empowerment rests in a commitment to work with team members by win-win agreements. In an organization, win-win means that there is an explicit overlapping of the four needs of the organization, that is, its financial health, the growth and development of its people, the nature of the synergistic relationships with key stakeholders, and then finally with meaning and contribution and integrity. You would overlap those with the four needs of the individual, the physical or economic, the mental, their growth and development, the social-emotional, that is, relationships, and the spiritual, meaning and contribution and integrity. If someone violates the spirit of the agreement and continues to do so in spite of sincere efforts to heal the breach, then the individuals may simply go for no deal. That means you don't deal at all. There is no agreement. You agree to disagree agreeably. People leave. Hires aren't made. New assignments may be made. There is a very interesting approach to no deal that is promulgated by the armed services. It's called the Doctrine of Stubborn Refusal. I learned the Doctrine of Stubborn Refusal from interacting with naval officers. It means that when you know something is wrong and that it would result in serious consequences to the overall mission and values of the organization, then you should respectfully push back. No matter what your position or rank, you should speak up and declare yourself in opposition to the momentum of a growing decision that you are absolutely convinced is dead wrong. That's essentially living from your conscience, allowing your inner voice or light to guide your actions rather than giving in to the sway of peer pressure. It is important for people in high positions to officially endorse the doctrine of stubborn refusal. This legitimizes the right to push back, to call wrong wrong, and to call stupid stupid. New heading, Empowerment and Performance Appraisal. When you think about it, who should evaluate a person's progress and achievements? That person should. Traditional performance appraisal is clearly one of the bloodletting management practices of our day. As mentioned before, this is where the boss basically interviews an employee and uses the sandwich technique. Say a few nice words, slip in the knife, twist it a few times, called areas for improvement, and then pat them on their way. When you have a high-trust culture, helpful systems, and people on the same page, then people are in a far better position to evaluate themselves, particularly if they have 360-degree feedback data from sources around them. In almost all cases, self-evaluation is tougher than anyone else's evaluation. The bosses know the least. They are the furthest removed. Codependent people tell them what they like to hear, and they become isolated and insulated from what is in fact going on. The subordinates know next best, and then the peers. Again, in both of the biblical parables of the pounds and the talents that we mentioned near the beginning of chapter 6, the employee evaluates self, and the master either diminishes or enlarges stewardship. It would be so misaligned to think that after all this empowerment and honoring of people's power to choose in reaching top priority goals, that you would suddenly set up a so-called boss to be the big judge and evaluator. The so-called big boss should become the humble servant leader who runs alongside asking questions such as, "How is it going?" The worker knows how it's going far better than any boss does, particularly if feedback systems have been established, including feedback from the boss and from all of the other stakeholders who are influenced by the work of the person, including financial data. So the question, "How is it going?" is answered by the person himself or herself according to the terms of the agreed-upon compelling balanced scoreboard. Another 360-degree stakeholder information. The second question is, what are you learning? A person here may reveal both insight and ignorance, but the point is that they are responsible. The third question is, what are your goals, or what are you trying to accomplish? It identifies the connection between the vision and the reality. This leads naturally to the fourth question. How can I help you? Clearly communicating, I am your helper. I am your enabler, your servant. The servant leader might even tap into his or her own experience or awareness to see if that needs to be drawn upon. The key to this exchange is authentic Indian talking stick type communication. No game playing, no political posturing, no protective defensive communication, no kissing up, no telling others what they want to hear. Then the final question, how am I doing as your helper, communicates open, respectful, mutual accountability. Sometimes facing reality is difficult, especially when hearing it from others. But we demean and insult other people when we treat them as anyone other than accountable, responsible, choice-making individuals. If in the name of being nice and kind, we start protecting them, we begin the process of the codependency and silent conspiracy that eventually results in the lowest level of initiative, wait until told. It is when the spirit of servant leadership takes hold in a team and between a manager or team and an associate that the third form of trust mentioned in Chapter 9 fully blossoms, the empowering side. Again, it's the trust that one person or team consciously chooses to give to another, an act that leads me to feel your belief that I can add value. You give me trust and I return it. Trust then becomes a verb and a noun. When it is both a verb and a noun, It is something shared and reciprocated between people. That is the essence of how a person becomes the leader of their boss. They merit trust by giving it. Trust, the verb, comes from the potential trustworthiness of the one receiving the trust and the clear trustworthiness of the one giving the trust. The fourth role, empowering, embodies making trust a verb. New heading, the case of the janitors, or turning manual workers into knowledge workers. The following is a true story of a whole person in a whole job. It illustrates what can happen in a job that, though honorable, is by nature more menial, unskilled, and low-paid, janitoring. The idea is that if you can get a whole person in a whole job that consists of emptying garbage cans, sweeping and mopping floors, and washing walls and fixtures, etc., you could have it in any job. A management development instructor was once training a group of first-level supervisors on how to enrich a job so that it intrinsically motivated employees. One of the foremen who supervised janitors gave considerable resistance to the theory. It seemed too idealistic and unrelated to most of the work that a janitor does, at least the janitors he supervised. All of the supervisors being trained agreed that there was a problem with the janitors. They agreed with the supervisor that most of their janitors were uneducated, transient, and that they were there because they couldn't get a better job. Essentially, their only desire was to clock in and clock out. Some were even alcoholics. Because the instructor knew the maintenance foreman was sincere in his belief that motivation and empowerment theory was of no use to him in working with janitors, he abandoned his prepared discussion and began to deal with the janitorial problem directly. He placed three words on the blackboard: plan, do, and evaluate. Three major elements of job enrichment. He then asked the maintenance foreman and the other foreman to list the maintenance duties and activities associated with these three words. Some aspects of the planning part of the job were establishing schedules for maintenance, selecting and purchasing waxes and polishes, and determining which janitor covered which areas of the plant. During the discussion, the maintenance foreman said that he was about to purchase several new floor polishing and scrubbing machines. All of these planning activities were carried out by the maintenance foreman. Listed under the doing section were the normal activities of janitors: sweeping, scrubbing, waxing, removing the rubbish and refuse. The evaluating part of the job included such activities as routine daily checks on the cleanliness of the plant by the maintenance foreman, evaluation of the effectiveness of different soaps, waxes, and polishes, reflecting on trial efforts, identifying ways of improving, and ensuring that the cleaning schedules were maintained. Additionally, the maintenance foreman also contacted vendors to determine the type of new machines that he could purchase. When the various activities had been listed, the instructor asked, which of these activities could be done by the janitors? For example, why do you, Mr. Foreman, determine which soaps to buy? Why not let your janitors decide? What about having the salesman give the demonstration of the new machine to the janitors and let them decide which of the machines is best? How about having the janitors identify parts of the job they would be interested in taking on? In the actual situation, the wording was not quite so blunt, and the entire group of foremen got involved in the discussion about what additional areas of planning and evaluating could be given to the janitors. Over the next 5 months, the case of the janitors was discussed at least briefly in every session held by the instructor. Meanwhile, the maintenance supervisor was engaging more of the minds and hearts of the janitors by steadily giving them more responsibility for the planning, doing, and evaluating of their work. They tested out new machines and made the final recommendations for purchase. They experimented with different waxes to determine which stood up the best under normal usage. They began examining the cleaning schedule to determine how much attention should be given to each area. For example, one area that had been wet-mopped daily was mopped only as needed after visual inspection. The janitors developed their own criteria for determining plant cleanliness and began to exert peer pressure on janitors who did not meet the norms. Little by little, these janitors took over all three tasks so that their best thinking was tapped, body, mind, heart, and spirit. The net effect, to the surprise of most, was that quality went up, job turnover and discipline problems went way down, social norms developed around initiative, cooperation, diligence, and quality, and job satisfaction increased significantly. In short, they had a turned-on group of janitors, all because the supervisors allowed or empowered the whole person to do the whole job. They had directed autonomy. The janitors no longer needed supervision or management because they supervised or managed themselves according to the criteria that they themselves helped develop. Perhaps more importantly, other foremen began thinking about how they could apply the same principles in their own areas, especially since they could begin to see for themselves the results of the maintenance foreman's work with the janitors. New heading, Service and Meaning. If we put this plan to evaluate idea into our whole person model of leadership, this is what it would look like. For the mind, plan. For the body, do. For the heart, evaluate. And at the center for the spirit, serve. The fourth element, serve, is added at the center to acknowledge the need of the spirit for meaning and contribution. You can see that even the janitors in this case began to experience great meaning in their work. They developed deep pride of workmanship, and it began to lift the level of quality in the entire plant. They found their voice. This doesn't mean that they wanted to do janitoring work the rest of their lives. It merely means that at that time, they found a sense of fulfillment and meaning in their work by being treated as a knowledge worker. You might ask, well, if you empower people to this extent, why do you need supervisors at all? The simple answer is that supervisors, managers, and so forth are needed to set up the conditions of empowerment and then to get out of people's way, clear the path, and become a source of help as requested. This is servant leadership. After all, your job is not about getting your ego stroked. It's about getting the job done. You might be interested to know that only 45% of the XQ respondents say they feel that their contributions at work are recognized and appreciated. New heading, Choices Revisited. The case of the janitors is a good reminder that people make choices in their work based on how well the four areas of their nature are respected and engaged. Each choice is made in response to a deeper motivation that ranges from anger, fear, and reward to duty, love, and meaning. Duty, love, and meaning are the highest sources of human motivation and will always produce the greatest and most enduring achievements. Leadership draws on the highest of all human impulses. Managing people like things reduces human beings to their lowest instincts. It is modern-day bloodletting and usually results in rebelling, quitting, malicious obedience, and usually at best, willing compliance. As briefly mentioned before, this story also illustrates an extremely important point. It is the leadership beliefs and style of the manager, not the nature of the job or economic era, that defines whether a person is a knowledge worker or not. If he is not perceived as a knowledge worker, that is, if a janitor is not seen as the local expert on janitorial work, then he is a manual worker and not a knowledge worker. Now let's view a film we could call The Nature of Leadership. In fact, this film is very much like the opening film in the book, talking about to live, to love, to learn, to leave a legacy. But this will give you an opportunity to personally reflect on the underlying principles of this leadership framework of the four roles of leadership, and it will challenge you to internalize and act upon them. Nature is the backdrop and the teacher. I believe it will inspire you as it has me, and it will help demonstrate how the four roles of leadership are the framework for focus and execution. Again, you will find this film and all of the others on the book's companion DVD. So on the menu, select The Nature of Leadership. Here are a few common questions dealing with the four roles of leadership. One is, you talk about a complementary team. I'm a loner, with no staff or direct reports, and I have to wear all of the hats. How do I develop a complementary team to compensate for my weaknesses? My response is that until you have other people to whom you can delegate, so that your strength can be made productive and your weakness made irrelevant by their strengths, you will need to either reach at least a threshold level of competence on your weaknesses or outsource to advisors or suppliers who can compensate. Otherwise, your very strengths can prove to be your undoing. Another question. How do you empower employees in an environment that is highly regulated with the constant intrusion of new mandates, policies, and regulations? My answer, I would turn to the employees and ask them that question. What do you suggest? What is your opinion? I mean it. I would lay it right on their platter. People are amazingly creative and resilient, and no matter how oppressive a regulatory environment may be, if the work is meaningful, you'll always be able to find some areas of creative opportunity where people can exercise their own judgment. In terms of establishing agreements, the regulations are to be clearly indicated as guidelines, even rules to be followed. I lived in England one time and saw the railroad people become disgusted because of the extreme regulatory environment. They decided, okay, we're going to follow the rules to the hilt, and it literally brought all of England to a standstill. None of the trains arrived on time. It was totally chaotic, simply because they had strictly followed the checklist of rules. The only way they succeeded before had been through their own creativity, initiative, and resourcefulness. Once this became clearly evident, the administrators began to put more value on human judgment than on rules, and it began to work again. You may be able to set up a pilot or experimental program that will produce better results at lower costs and without violating any jugular rules. The risk is less and the learning potential is great, and you may begin to discriminate more carefully between rules that are jugular and those that are peripheral or purely cultural artifacts. I once worked with the highly regulated nuclear power industry. The level of cooperation and communication, even between competitors, was astounding, because they all knew that if they had one more Three Mile Island incident, it could shut down the entire industry. On their own, they shared every incident or situation that produced any element of risk or breach of safety. The regulatory administrators of the government could not even begin to ratchet up the regulations high enough to compare to what these competitive companies did on their own. Another question. How do you enforce accountability in a win-win way? Doesn't the spirit of win-win tend to go soft on accountability? My answer, absolutely not. The key is to establish accountability against mutually agreed-upon desired results. Use a balanced scoreboard on these results with both logical and natural consequences that follow the accountability. Without a balanced scoreboard and agreed-upon desired results and consequences, win-lose will end up becoming lose-win, and in the long run, lose-lose. Another question. How do you deal with the maverick employee, one who just seems to buck at every decision and does his own thing in his own way? My answer, a lot of significant progress is made by mavericks. There should always be a place for people who think differently and who are fresh and creative in their thought processes. Learn to appreciate the unique strengths of each person. However, if their maverickness reaches the point where they are poisonous, negative, and critical, Then I would say, set up a feedback system that gives them feedback. Let them soak in others' candid perceptions and the feelings around those perceptions of them until they make their own minds up about what they really want to do. If a maverick is a deviant kind of person who really gets his psychological jollies from violating social norms, and if he adds no real value through creative and innovative contributions, you may need to go into outplacement services. There are a lot of people who are independents. They're not interdependent, but they're also not deviants, and they can play a very important role in independent-oriented kinds of jobs. The real key is to create a culture that embraces diversity within the context of unified purposes and values. As the great sociologist Emile Durkheim put it, when mores are sufficient, laws are unnecessary. When mores are insufficient, laws are unenforceable. Close quote. Another question. I personally have a strong need to be in control, and this whole idea of release scares me, even though it makes sense. Can I change? My response is, absolutely, you are not an animal. Although you're influenced by, you're not a product of nature and nurture. You are a product of your own choices. But you would have to begin to change at the personal level by using your own three unique human endowments, the power of choice, principles, and your four intelligences or capacities. Through persistence and patience, you will overcome these control needs, and as you grow in confidence with just a few people closely around you at home and at work, you will come to feel that there is more productivity and peace of mind in teaching principles by both precept and example, as well as in letting others govern themselves. Eventually, you will learn how to institutionalize this kind of moral authority in systems, structures, and processes. The new section in the book and the fifth level of economic eras is called the Age of Wisdom. This leads us to chapter 14, titled The Eighth Habit and the Sweet Spot. Mahatma Gandhi once taught, "The difference between what we are doing and what we're capable of doing would solve most of the world's problems." The eighth habit, find your voice and inspire others to find theirs, is an idea whose time has come. "Whose time has come" is a phrase from the famous line by Victor Hugo quoted earlier. There is nothing so powerful as an idea whose time has come. The reason why the eighth habit is such an idea is that it embodies an understanding of the whole person, an understanding that gives its possessors the key to crack open the limitless potential of the knowledge worker economy. The industrial age manual worker economy was based on a part or fragmented person paradigm. In today's world, this lower road leads to mediocrity at best. It literally straitjackets human potential. Organizations mired in the mindset of the industrial age continue to have the people at the top make all the important decisions and the rest wield the screwdrivers. What an enormous waste. What an enormous loss. Remember again the statement by author John Gardner. Most ailing organizations have developed a functional blindness to their own defects. They are not suffering because they cannot resolve their problems, but because they cannot see their problems. This is exactly what has happened. The eighth habit gives you a mindset and a skill set to constantly look for the potential in people. It's the kind of leadership that communicates to people their worth and potential so clearly they come to see it in themselves. To do this, we must listen to people. We must involve and continually affirm them by our words and through all four roles of leadership. Here is a succinct and summary way to remember what each role does. Notice how each role directly or indirectly affirms people's worth as whole people and empowers the unleashing of their potential. First, modeling, both as an individual and as a complementary team. Modeling inspires trust without expecting it. When people live by the principles embodied in the eighth habit, trust, the glue of life, flourishes. Trust comes only through trustworthiness. In short, modeling produces personal moral authority. Second, pathfinding. Pathfinding creates order without demanding it. This means that when people identify and are involved in the strategic decisions, particularly on values and high-priority goals, they emotionally connect. The locus of both management and motivation goes from the outside to the inside. Pathfinding produces visionary moral authority. Third, aligning. Aligning structures, systems, and processes is a form of nourishing the body politic and the spirit of trust, vision, and empowerment. Aligning produces institutionalized moral authority. And fourth, empowering. Empowering is the fruit of the other three roles, modeling, pathfinding, and aligning. It unleashes human potential without external motivation. Empowering produces cultural moral authority. Remember, the most important modeling is done by the leader when he or she models the other three roles. In other words, pathfinding is modeling the courage to determine a course and the humility and mutual respect to involve others in deciding what matters most. Aligning is modeling the willingness to set up structures, systems, and processes that are congruent with what matters most, strategic decisions, so that the organization stays constantly focused on its highest priority goals. Empowering is modeling a bone-deep belief in people's capacity to choose and in the four parts of their nature through commissioning processes. New heading, focus and execution. In a sense, I suggest that all that we have covered can be essentially summarized in two words, focus and execution. In these two words, we truly find simplicity on the far side of complexity. Again, focus deals with what matters most, and execution deals with making it happen. The cutting-edge bestseller business book by Ron Chiron and Larry Bossidy called Execution, The Discipline of Getting Things Done, has been influential in my thinking behind this two-word summary. In this book, they said, leadership without the discipline of execution is incomplete and ineffective. Without the ability to execute, all other attributes of leadership become hollow. No company can deliver on its commitments or adapt well to change unless all leaders practice the discipline of execution at all levels. Execution has to be part of a company's strategy in its goals. It is the missing link between aspirations and results. Close quote. The first two roles of leadership, modeling and pathfinding, can be summarized in the one word, focus. The next two roles of leadership, aligning and empowering, can be summarized in one word, execution. How is this so? Well, just think about it. Pathfinding is essentially strategic work. It's deciding what the higher priority goals are, what values are to serve as guidelines in accomplishing and sustaining those goals. But this requires both a clear understanding and a commitment in the culture toward those goals. Such commitment is based upon trust, trustworthiness, and synergy, the essence of the first role, modeling. So only when there is true personal and interpersonal trustworthiness will trust develop and team synergy be effective. This personal, interpersonal, and team modeling involves mutual respect, mutual understanding, and creative cooperation. Essentially, habits 4, 5, and 6, in producing a clear, committed set of high-priority goals, habit 2, begin with the end in mind. This personal, interpersonal trustworthiness is in turn based on people being true to their values and goals. In other words, personal focus and execution. This is habit 3, put first things first. The expression first things first is another way of describing focus and execution. The next two roles of leadership, aligning and empowering, represent the execution. This means creating structures, systems, and processes, that is aligning, that intentionally enable individuals and teams to translate the organization's larger line-of-sight strategic goals or critical priorities, pathfinding, into their actual day-to-day work and team goals. In short, people are empowered to get the job done. Focus and execution are inseparably connected. In other words, until you have people on the same page, they will not execute consistently. If you use the industrial age command and control transaction model to get focus, you won't be able to use the knowledge worker age empowerment transformation model to get execution, simply because without involvement and/or identification, you will not get enough emotional commitment to the focus. Execution will simply not take place. Likewise, if you use the knowledge worker involvement empowerment approach to achieve a common focus, but then an industrial age command and control approach for execution, you won't be able to maintain the focus because people will perceive the lack of sincerity and integrity. On the other hand, if you use the knowledge age model for both focus, that is modeling and pathfinding, and execution, that is aligning and empowering, you will produce integrity and trustworthiness in the organizational culture. The organization will not only find its voice, but will also use its voice to superbly serve its purposes and stakeholders. New heading: The Great Execution Gap. Early in the book, I made the statement, to know and not to do is really not to know. This is a very profound truth, because the principles encompassed in the eighth habit are of little worth until they, by practice and execution, become part of our character and skill set, until they become a habit. Consider and ponder on the words of the anonymous author. I am your constant companion. I am your greatest helper or heaviest burden. I will push you onward or drag you down to failure. I am completely at your command. Half the things you do, you might just as well turn over to me, and I will be able to do them quickly, correctly. I am easily managed. You must merely be firm with me. Show me exactly how you want something done, and after a few lessons, I will do it automatically. I am the servant of all great people, and alas, of all failures as well. Those who are failures, I have made failures. I am not a machine, though I work with all of the precision of a machine plus the intelligence of a human being. You may run me for a profit or turn me for ruin. It makes no difference to me. Take me, train me, be firm with me, and I will place the world at your feet. Be easy with me, and I will destroy you. Who am I? I am habit. Execution is the great unaddressed issue in most organizations today. It is one thing to have clear strategy. It is quite another to actually implement and realize the strategy, that is, to execute. In fact, most leaders would agree that they'd be better off having an average strategy with superb execution than a superb strategy with poor execution. Those who execute always have the upper hand. As IBM leader Louis V. Gerstner Jr. put it, all of the great companies in the world out-execute their competitors day in and day out in the marketplace, in their manufacturing plants, in their logistics, in their inventory turns, in just about everything they do. Rarely do great companies have a proprietary position that insulates them from the constant hand-to-hand combat of competition. Close quote. There are many things that affect execution, but our XQ research shows that there are six core drivers to execution inside an organization: clarity, commitment, translation, enabling, synergy, and accountability. It follows then that breakdowns in execution typically occur as failures in one or more of these six drivers. We call them execution gaps. Let's explore each in turn. Clarity. People don't clearly know what the goals or priorities of their team or organization are. Commitment. People don't buy into the goals. Translation. People don't know what they individually need to do to help the team or organization achieve its goals. Enabling. People don't have the proper structure, systems, or freedom to do their jobs well. Synergy. People don't get along or work together well. And accountability. People don't regularly hold each other accountable. Peter Drucker once observed, "So much of what we call management consists of making it difficult for people to work." Let's look at these six execution gaps or drivers in the context of how the controlling industrial age mindset literally causes these gaps, and how the knowledge worker whole person model, which embodies the eighth habit, can solve them. First, clarity. The manual worker industrial age approach is simply to announce what the mission, vision, values, and high priority goals are. As we've discussed, these are often the product of top people going to off-site mission statement workshops and then returning to the workforce to announce in smooth language the strategic decisions to guide all other decisions in the organization. Then they communicate. But over time, these mission statements become nothing more than PR statements, simply because there is no real involvement. Therefore, there is no real identification, which is the essence of the knowledge worker age. Remember that identification is personal moral authority, coming from involvement with the admired person or complementary team, not necessarily from involvement in the strategic decisions. Second, commitment. The industrial age approach to getting commitment is to sell. Communicate it constantly and frequently. Explain it and try to make sense of it. Sell, sell, sell. But research data shows that only 1 in 5 have a passionate commitment to the high-priority goals of their team and organization. The eighth habit approach in the knowledge worker age is to put a whole person in a whole job, body, mind, heart, and spirit. Pay me fairly. Treat me kindly and respectfully. Use my mind creatively in doing work that truly adds value, and in doing it in a principle-centered way. It's not just a matter of what we have called the great jackass theory of human motivation, where you just throw more money at the workers. In fact, studies have shown that when you have a knowledge worker approach, workers place salary fourth in priority behind trust, respect, and pride. Why? Because when people have intrinsic satisfaction in their work, extrinsic or external factors are much less important. But when there are no intrinsic satisfactions in the work, then money becomes the most important thing. Why? With money you can buy satisfactions off the job. The whole person eighth habit unleashes internal motivation. The execution gaps of clarity and commitment are also the primary source of time management problems. There is one simple reason why. How people define the high-priority goals, along with mission and values, will govern every other decision. Therefore, when there is a lack of clarity and commitment, you will have nothing but confusion about what is truly important. The end result is that urgency will eventually define importance. That which is popular and pressing and proximate and pleasant, in other words, that which is urgent, becomes important. The net result is that everyone is reading the tea leaves, putting their finger to the political winds, and kissing up to the hierarchy. Then the confusion gets pushed down through the entire organization in a compounded way. So until people develop clarity and commitment toward the mission, vision, and values of the organization, no amount of time management training will have any sustaining impact, except in people's personal lives. As Charles Hummel once observed, "The important task rarely must be done today or even this week. But the urgent task calls for instant action. The momentary appeal of these tasks seems irresistible and important, and they devour our energy. But in the light of time's perspective, their deceptive prominence fades with a sense of loss we recall the vital task we pushed aside. We realize we become slaves to the tyranny of the urgent. Close quote. Third, translation. The industrial age approach is job descriptions. In the knowledge worker age, you help align people's jobs to their voices, that is, their talents and passions. And their jobs have a line of sight in accomplishing the team's and organization's high-priority goals. Fourth, enabling. In many ways, enabling is the toughest execution gap to deal with, because it requires you to remove all of the dysfunctional, structural, systemic, and other cultural barriers that we have been discussing through the book. These enabling or disabling structures and systems, recruiting, selecting, training and development, compensating, communicating, information, compensation, etc., are exactly where many people get their sense of security and predictability in their work life. Unless there is genuine involvement in the strategic decision-making, particularly regarding values and line-of-sight priorities, you will not get sufficient emotional connection, trust, and internal motivation to align deeply embedded structures and systems. In the industrial age, people are an expense, and things like equipment and technology are called an investment. Just think about this again. People, an expense. Things, an investment. This is the bottom line information system. It is sick bloodletting. With the eighth habit approach to the knowledge worker age, people can become involved in setting up a very powerful, visual, compelling, real-time scoreboard on both results and capability that reflects how well the systems and structures are aligned to enable key goals to be accomplished. Fifth, synergy. The industrial age is a compromise approach at best, and win-lose or lose-win at worst. Synergy in the knowledge worker age enables third alternatives to be created. It's an eighth habit kind of communication, where people's voices are identified and aligned with the organization or job's voice so that the voices of different teams or departments harmonize together. Sixth, accountability. The industrial age practices of carrot and stick motivation and sandwich technique performance appraisal are replaced by mutual accountability and by open sharing of information against the top priority goals that everyone understands, including a clearly understood scoreboard. It's almost like going into a soccer stadium or a football or baseball arena where the scoreboard displays information so that everyone in the entire arena knows exactly what's happening. New heading, the sweet spot. Let's tie all of this together. Early in the book, I introduced the idea that everyone chooses one of two roads in life. One is the well-traveled road to mediocrity, the other road to greatness. We've explored how the path to mediocrity straitjackets human potential, and how the path to greatness unleashes and realizes human potential. The eighth habit is the pathway to greatness, and greatness lies in finding your voice and inspiring others to find theirs. Together we've explored what we could call the three kinds of greatness: personal greatness, leadership greatness, and organizational greatness. Personal greatness is found as we discover our three birth gifts, choice, principles, and the four human intelligences. When we develop these gifts and intelligences, we cultivate a magnificent character full of vision, discipline, and passion that is guided by conscience, one that is simultaneously courageous and kind. This kind of character is driven to make significant contributions that not only serve mankind, but also reach and are focused on the One. Such character I would term primary greatness, whereas secondary greatness would include such things as talent, reputation, prestige, wealth, and recognition. Leadership greatness is achieved by people who, regardless of their position, choose to inspire others to find or create their voice. This is achieved through living the four roles of leadership. Organizational greatness is achieved as the organization tackles the final challenge of translating their leadership roles and work, including mission, vision, and values, into the principles or drivers of execution in an organization. Remember, clarity, commitment, translation, enabling, synergy, and accountability. These drivers are also universal, timeless, self-evident principles for organizations. I would like you now to envision a diagram that summarizes the relationship between personal greatness, leadership greatness, and organizational greatness. Organizations that govern and discipline themselves by all three truly hit what you might call the sweet spot. The sweet spot is the nexus where all three circles overlap: personal, leadership, and organizational greatness. This is where the greatest expression of power and potential is found. When you hit the sweet spot of a racket while playing tennis, or of the golf club when connecting with that little white ball, you'll know when you've hit it. It is exhilarating. It resonates. It just feels right. With no more effort than usual, that connection with the center releases a burst of power and the ball is sent soaring much further and faster than usual. It's another way of referring to the power that is released when you find your voice as an individual, team, or organization. So as you envision these three circles overlapping between personal greatness, leadership greatness, and organizational greatness, we'll call this eighth habit the sweet spot, where the voices have reached the ultimate level of unity and empowerment and beauty. And where that nexus is, there are four disciplines which, if practiced consistently, can close these execution gaps and vastly improve teams' and organizations' ability to focus on and execute their top priorities. We'll call them the four disciplines of execution. Of course, there are dozens of factors that influence execution. However, our research suggests that these four disciplines represent the 20% of activities that produce 80% of results, as they pertain to executing consistently with excellence on top priorities. You will notice that these four disciplines are consistent with and flow out of the three areas of greatness. This sweet spot, this power-releasing contact point, is the set of the next step actionable rubber meets the road laser-focused practices that will enable a team and organization to consistently get results. Here is a summary of these four disciplines. The four disciplines of execution, 4DX, we sometimes call it. Discipline 1. Focus on the wildly important. There is a key principle that many fail to understand about focusing an organization. People are naturally wired to focus on only one thing at a time, or at best, very few, with excellence. Suppose you have an 80% chance of achieving any particular goal with excellence. Add a second goal to that first goal, and research shows your chance of achieving both goals dropped to 64%. Keep adding goals and the probability of achieving them plunges steeply. Juggle 5 goals at once, for example, and you only have a 33% chance of actually getting excellent results on all of them. How vital it is, then, to focus diligently and intensely on only a few crucial goals. Some objectives are clearly more critical than others. We must learn to distinguish between what is merely important and what is wildly important. A wildly important goal, a WIG, carries serious consequences. Failure to achieve these goals renders all other achievements relatively inconsequential. Consider the situation of the air traffic controller. At any moment, hundreds of airplanes are in the air, and all of them are important, especially if you happen to be on one of them. But the controller cannot focus on them all at once. His or her job is to land them one at a time, and to do so flawlessly. Every organization is in a similar position. Few can afford the luxury of divided attention. Some goals simply must be landed right now. So if that next plane is not landed safely, you close down the airport. So how do we know which goals are wildly important and will best help us execute our strategic plan? Sometimes it is immediately clear and obvious. At other times, analysis is needed. The important screen is a valuable strategic planning tool that will help you prioritize your goals by running them through the economic, strategic, and stakeholder screens. In other words, running the issues and the decisions through these screens will help you access which of all of the potential goals would bring the most leverage in terms of economic, strategic, and stakeholder benefits. You may wish to use the important screen when determining your top goals. This is pathfinding at the cutting edge of action. In coming up with the WIGs, the wildly important goals, consider the following three screens. First, the stakeholder screen. What are the most important things you should do to fulfill the needs of your stakeholders? Customers, employees, suppliers, investors, and others all have a stake in these goals. Consider how the potential goals will increase customer loyalty, ignite the passion and energy of your people, favorably impact suppliers, vendors, business partners, and investors. Now let's look at the strategic screen. Consider how the potential goals affect the strategy of the organization, including whether or not the goal directly supports the organization's mission or purpose, leverages core competencies, increases market strength, and increases competitive advantage. Ask yourself, what is the most consequential thing we can do to advance